Hi, everybody. This is Stefan Molyneux from Free Domain, and we've got our Wednesday Night Live cooking away. Hope you're doing well. So I've really been thinking about this demoralization stuff. Demoralization. So what is demoralization? Demoralization is to make you feel like you're caught in a piece of giant machinery that's just going to disassemble you, your culture, your hope, your future, your country, whatever. And there's nothing you can do, this sort of slow hypnotic slide into disaster, like you are a leaf on a stream being carried down the river to a waterfall of impending doom. And there's nothing you can do. And it's all hopeless and it's all pointless. Give up, don't try. Retreat to hedonism, stimulate your dopamine with sex, porn, video games, drugs, distraction, Netflix and chill, whatever. Get game, play uselessly, don't think of marriage, don't think of kids. It is a seduction to have you do nothing while the tapestry woven for you to protect you by your ancestors is shredded, set on fire, and destroyed. Demoralization. Demoralization is inflicted in schools. It is inflicted by the media. It is inflicted by academia, higher education. It is everywhere, all over the place, no matter what. But primarily, demoralization is inflicted by your fellow man. You know that those CNN addicted aunts and uncles or grandparents or whatever, what they do is they, well, it's just like this. Well, it's just like that. Well, it's just like the other. Well, you know, Donald Trump is in the Epstein files and he's a blah, 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 blah. When, of course, I mean, I was reporting on this way back in the day. Back in 2015, like 11 years ago, I was reporting that Donald Trump kicked Epstein out of Mar-a-Lago because Epstein hit on a 14-year-old, a 15-year-old, a 16-year-old. I mean, I've heard various reports. And now there's a cop's notes saying that when they began investigating Epstein, like the whole thing started because there was a bunch of girls fighting in high school and one of them called the other a prostitute, and then they searched the girl's bag. She had $300 cash. Where did you get this? Well, there's this nice boy, or this nice older salt and pepper, long horse-faced man who gives me money for massages, right? These were underage girls. So that's how the whole thing kind of got set in motion. And when the investigation began to talk to people who knew Epstein, of course, Donald Trump was one of them. Donald Trump said, oh, thank God, everybody knows this guy's been doing this terrible stuff for years. We've been complaining, and Ghislaine Maxwell is stone evil, and, you know, get this guy. And he cooperated, and he tried to help out. Now, Trump is a hound dog, for sure. He seemed to sleep with everything that had a pulse and a half, and he's been married a bunch of times and all of that. But he's not that predatory on children guy, for sure. So, of course, I was talking about all of that, but people, they just hear stuff, they believe stuff, or the world is going to end, right? Doom, 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 doom. If the elites genuinely believed, say, that global warming was a big issue, and this was all the way back to, God, I did my first show on global warming in like 2009, 2010, just about how it was all nonsense. So, you know, coming on 17 plus years. If the elites truly believed in global warming, it's just an IQ test. If they believed that high carbon footprints were going to cause the end of civilization, they would never, ever allow for mass immigration. Never, ever allow for mass immigration. Because mass immigration takes people, human beings, from low carbon footprint to very high carbon footprint. So the fact that they want fund mass immigration, rather than just having AI and robots, which is what Japan is going to do, they have instead championed mass immigration, which is massively increasing the carbon footprint of the planet. If they believed, as is always said, you know, there's this fucking overused word, I can't stand it, existential. It's an existential threat. Bah! It doesn't just threaten human beings, it threatens the fabric of existence itself. It's existential threat. If they believed there was an existential threat to humanity, they would cut welfare, because welfare encourages people to have more children, particularly poor people, often not the smartest clumps of brain cells in the known universe. So they would cut welfare, they would cut government spending, they would not do any debt, they would cut back on fiat currency, they would make sure absolutely that there would be no mass immigration, they would stop sending food to the third world, which encourages more people to have more children. They would have done all of that if they even remotely believed that it was an existential threat to humanity. So, I mean, the fact, I don't know. Look, I'm very smart at some things. I don't really think this is a big intellectual challenge. This is just like, you know, just think about it a little bit. We're not asking you to go get a PhD in astrophysics or quantum mechanics, or, you know, pass out the lyrics to Hotel California, or figure out what type of girls Brian May was singing about or writing about in Fat Bottom Girls. Nobody's asking you to become a stone genius. It's just, you know, think it through a tiny, tiny little bit. That's all. Just think it through a tiny, tiny little bit. If they thought it was an existential threat, they would do everything, move every mountain, do everything in their power, right? They would not bring people from low pollution footprints to high pollution footprints, because that would only accelerate the death of the universe. So it's all a nonsense. So demoralization is when they constantly bombard you with threats and punishment for facts and deplatforming for, you know, basic realities, while at the same time telling you, like, they're pro-science, right? Yeah, trust the experts. Oh, not the IQ experts. So trust the experts. Ooh, not the people who are saying that immigration is going to increase humanity's carbon footprint. Don't trust those experts. Don't trust those. Don't trust the experts that we pay. Only trust the experts that are beholden to and ensnared and have sold their souls to the existing system. Only, like, how about you only fund those experts that are funded by child predators like Jeffrey Epstein? How about you just trust those experts, or those experts that are funded by Big Pharma, or rely upon Anthony Fauci for their grants and careers? Those experts you can trust, but by God, you better not trust your own thinking. You better not trust your own reasoning. You better not trust your own basic fact processing. So you're bombarded with doom, death, decay, and evil, right? Of course, if you're white, in particular, if you're a white male, it's just your evil, 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 and white privilege, which is like the N-word for white people. And you apparently are the only culture that ever owned slaves. You're the only culture that ever engaged in colonialism. You're the only culture that has uniquely evil footprint on the face of humanity with your bloody Greek-based Achilles heel of corruption, and so on. So they'll bombard you with your evil. You're bad for being a male. You're bad for being white. You're doomed. The world is going to end. And all of this is designed to corrupt your nature from K-selected to R-selected. For those who don't know what that means, gene wars, G-E-N-E wars. Gene wars is what you want to watch. They want to move you from long-term pair bonding, high investment in children mindset to short-term sterile rabbit fucking with no pair bonding and particularly no children. We'll sell you sex, lots of sex, but in return, just don't have kids. Right? And this is, you know, one of the things that happens that's kind of fascinating to me is, I mean, if you tell me what you guys think. If you've been to university, went to university, you know, I always thought, you know, university, man, university's going to be really tough because, you know, I got high standards, and because they had relatively high standards back in the 12th century when I went. Ah, St. Abelard, a wonderful mentor. But I was like, wow, this is going to be tough, man. Whew. Ooh, I mean, high school was tough. In many ways. I mean, English and history and all the stuff that I'm sort of naturally good at and naturally like to read, that was pretty easy. But, you know, I had to take grade 12 functions and relations, vector calculus. I used to know a man in Prague named Vector Calculus. He ran the blondes through the Tate sluice gates. So I thought, man, university is going to be good. It's going to be tough. And university was not tough. I was like, wait, what? I got to do like, I'm going to go to 12 hours classes a week? What? Why? Why would I only have 12 hours of classes a week? Oh, wow. Okay, so I get to spend a lot of time in the quad. Ooh, subsidized food. Ooh, there's lots of parties, lots of dances. Lots of fun stuff to do. Lots of sports. I can go to the gym a lot. It was pretty, I mean, university bakes laziness into your very bones. It's just like being some rich aristocrat, like Freddy in a room with a view. Oh, what lovely bones. Just fascinating. I could just study these bones while I play tennis on the back quad and occasionally get a slight cardio shoulder workout by flogging a peasant or two. Delightful. So it makes you lazy, makes you hedonistic, makes you aristocratic. And then, of course, after you've spent a couple of years in the slowly state-thudding heartbeat amniotic sac of higher education, you then pop out into the world. If you're lucky, you get to just keep doing higher education. Oh, fine, might as well do a master's. Oh, dab a little bit in PhD. Or you vault from there into some, you know, cushy government job where you never really have to work. And then by the time that any kind of real work hits you, you're in your late 20s or early 30s, and it's just too much of a shock. Too much of a shock. Plus, of course, it burdens you down with debt, which is another demoralizing thing. It's another demoralizing thing. And, you know, the 11 guys in India have just been caught because they've produced, 100,000 fake diplomas in nursing, in being a doctor, in being a lawyer, in being an engineer. There's all these fake. And of course, you know, just a lot of people have just come over on these H-1Bs or other kind of visas from India and other places. They don't have any particular credentials. It's just photocopy. And, they're able to do stuff, which means that a lot of the requirements are just largely bullshit because you can just copy paste some diploma and go and work in the high echelons of tech and finance and medicine and law. Maybe not law. I guess they wouldn't accept a law degree from Uttar Pradesh or Mumbai or some places like that. But yeah, other places, why not? So you're buried in debt. You believe the world is going to end. And you have trained yourself to chase after empty dopamine. And you never think of kids. You know, I was thinking just the other day. I was thinking when I was younger, nobody ever really talked about or thought about having kids, or you weren't around kids. There's this sort of video on X. It's quite moving, actually, where this woman, I think she's in her early 30s, and she was the kid. She was the young woman who never wanted kids. She never wanted kids. She's going to be a career girl. And she just, factory reset is hit when she holds an actual baby and just like bursts into tears and can barely breathe with the passion and the love and the devotion she feels towards a baby. I remember a friend of mine who was, I guess he would be an incel back in the day. Unfortunately, the single son of a single mother is just brutal. Just brutal. And he was over at his mom's place with a bunch of other women, and there were grandmothers, and there was a kid over there, a baby over there, and the baby was crying, and somebody asked my friend, just call him Bob, it's not his name, somebody asked my friend Bob to hold the baby, and all the other women were like, no, you never give a crying baby to a bachelor. Never give a crying baby to a bachelor. Just boom, right? So that's the, but you used to grow up around kids all the time. You know, I was at the tail end of the baby boom, so there weren't that many kids or babies when, but they were around everywhere. My aunts were having babies and cousins, and all babies. And when I went to Africa, my, you know, friends of my father's had babies and toddlers and all of that, because I first went when I was 6 years old, just around babies a lot. But these days, man, babies are kept out of sight. I don't know where they go, like an alternate dimension, daycare or something like that. There's babies aren't around. So people don't think about it. And nobody ever talked to me about having kids, getting married, and babies. It just did not come up. I mean, there was all of this stuff in health class, right, about don't get pregnant. Here are the STDs. I remember there was some hideous story about some woman who tried using Lysol to spray her vagina but fused the skin shut in some horrifying way. But nothing about, you know, here's your fertility window and you got to have kids by this and time and so on. Because if you're a woman and you don't have kids by the age of 30, it's 50-50 that you're never going to have kids at all. That's rough, man. Talk about not fulfilling the entire purpose and meaning of being here. Because meaning is only sought by people who are addicted to dopamine and can't get it for whatever reason. Then they say, oh, what's the meaning? What's the meaning? You know, you're holding a baby, raising a child and, you know, doing good in the world. I mean, nobody ever thinks about meaning. Meaning is just a void. It's an anxiety and an existential, oh, there it goes, that word, dread that rushes in to fill your heart when you're not doing anything meaningful with your life, just sort of chasing dopamine like any particular rabbit. As somebody says, my single mom aborted my younger siblings after my dad left. Yeah. I mean, I was saying this on X, and this is also part of demoralization, is, well, like once you can get people to behave in just horrendous ways, then it's also demoralizing. The demoralization hits from your peers, right? And that is really rough on people as a whole. So you know, this sort of cheering on of abortion that goes on. Like I was saying this on X, and this is something that is just a basic fact. Women don't want their rights. They don't want their freedoms. I think, I mean, I'm just, cause I'm an empiricist, right? This is not whether this is right or wrong or good or bad. I'm just telling you what is. This is what is. Women do not want their freedoms. They do not want their privileges. It is destroying them, and they are doing everything possible, except for admitting that they were wrong. Not always the most common thing for a lot of people, maybe slightly a little bit more difficult for women. But they don't want their rights and privileges. Because the only way that women in the West, right? The only way that Western women get to keep their rights and privileges is if they have a lot of babies. Because let's say that you get people from, slightly foreign cultures that don't historically have a huge track record of respecting the rights and privileges of women. If women vote to import all of these other cultures, and they don't have their own children, and then they vote for more welfare so that other cultures can have more children, then the Western man gets pushed aside demographically over time. And then women will lose their rights. I mean, the only way that women can even remotely retain any of their rights is to have more Western kids, because it's in the West that the respect for women is at its absolute highest, perhaps even a pathological state-based elevation. But you'd think that they'd want to hold on to these rights if they love them so much. So then, again, I don't judge people by what they say. I only judge people by what they do. And women, by wanting to import cultures that don't respect women as much and not having kids and raising them in the Western tradition, are guaranteeing that their rights won't continue. And I think that's a real shame, to be honest. I mean, I have a daughter. I would love for her to be free in the West, not privileged, but free in the West. And it's sad. And this is like forevermore. This is the new Eve. This is the new Garden of Eden thing, that women uniting with the state cause mass mayhem. I mean, since Roe v. Wade was legalized, more women have killed more people in the womb than all of men throughout all of human history have killed each other. And that's pretty rough to see. And women are desperate to get out from this privilege, but they can't admit that they were wrong. And so they're just engineering things so that the privilege ends. It's a shame. And this is going to be forever. Like forever and ever, amen. I think it's a real shame in human history. But forever and ever, amen. People are going to look back upon this time and say, okay, so the cultures that didn't listen to their women spread far faster and far more aggressively and far more successfully than the cultures that did listen to their women. And unfortunately, women are just making sure that in the future, they won't ever be elevated in this way. Again, it's a real shame. Like in all seriousness, it's really heartbreaking, but that is the fact. Because otherwise, you know, women, as they've gained more and more privileges through the government, and privilege makes you miserable because it's irrational and it's predatory. And so as women have gained more privileges, they have become progressively more miserable. So the way to sort of understand it is that if you win the lottery, this happens with a lot of people who win the lottery, right? If you win the lottery, then if you feel bad or your life gets worse because you win the lottery, which is very common, right? If you win the lottery and the money is making you miserable, everybody wants you around just for your money. It turns out it doesn't buy you happiness. It doesn't buy you love and so on. And you are unhappy to have this money. Well, you can't admit that, right? You can't admit that and say, oh man, this money is making me miserable, and give it away to some worthy cause or whatever you're going to do. So what do? If you feel foundationally miserable because you have all of this money, well, what do? Well, you blow it. You invest in ostrich farms in Greenland. You go gambling, you get involved in various other schemes that people have to supposedly make you money. You invest in HawkTuas meme coins or whatever nonsense is going on. And then your money is gone. Oh, and you know, you're unhappy or the money's gone. But secretly, you're relieved, right? Like if you're a gambling addict and you have no car, but there's only one casino on the bus route, and then that casino burns to the ground or just closes or something. I mean, but secretly you're relieved. You're secretly relieved because being a gambling addict is kind of destroying your life. So people will often do that kind of stuff. A woman who wants to break up with a man will often provoke him until he gets really angry and upset and frustrated. And then he's a psycho, he's a narcissist and so on, even though there's very few people who are diagnosed narcissists. All women date them apparently all the time. And so she will provoke things so that something negative happens, and then they get out. She gets out. She's fine. She's out. So she can't admit that she was wrong and say, ooh, you know, this is not a good relationship. My friends did warn me, blah, blah, blah. She has to wait until it gets really bad, and then it just ends. So she'll nag at him, and she'll start doing crazy things like, I don't know, going to the club and revealing outfits. And then when he says, I don't really want you to do that, she's like, he was so controlling, right? He was just such a bully. Wouldn't let me express myself. I just wanted to move in my feminine energy. And, you know, you see this all over the moment a woman uses the word energy, it's just IQ tranched down to the center of the planet. But yeah, the way that women as a whole are acting is that they don't want, right? And they won't relinquish any of their privilege in the same way that the guy who's won the lottery won't relinquish any of his money, but they're eliminating it in other ways, in many ways, through basically not having kids and through their support of mass immigration. They're absolutely guaranteeing that the rights and privileges will go bye-bye, bye-bye. And I mean, maybe it's the same thing that happened with Iran, right? You see all these pictures of Iran before the, 1979 revolution with the Khomeini. And they obviously didn't really like that either. And yeah. Well, so, sorry, let me get to your questions and comments. And I hope you're having a lovely evening. freedomain.com/donate if you'd like to help out the show. Also wanted to mention, I have actually some, some openings next week. Had a cancellation or two for conversations. If you want to do a call-in that's free or a call-in that's paid, freedomain.com/call. All right. Let's see. Let's see here. Only approved experts like Chomsky you can trust. Yeah. Yeah. So, of course, if you care about a moralist, there comes a time where you find out, hopefully, you know, I don't think it'll be me. I'm pretty good guy. I don't have any particular skeletons in my closet, but at least I'm not friends with any pedos or anything. Any PDF files? Is that what they say to try and... I can't do it. Even if I get suppressed, I can't speak in this weird code. It's nothing wrong with it. It's just not my, I'd rather have fewer views and just be able to speak honestly. But I remember when I read, I think it was Barbara Brandon, the wife of Nathaniel Brandon, who was talking about what happened in the Ayn Rand Club. In the Ayn Rand Club, the Objectivist Club, they called themselves the Collective as kind of a joke. And Ayn Rand, of course, she had this terrible affair that went on for a long time and blew up the entire movement with Nathaniel Brandon. And Barbara Brandon was having like panic attacks because they told their spouses they had decided to have this affair. And Barbara Brandon, who was Nathaniel Brandon's wife, was having these panic attacks and was wandering around feeling wretched. But they'd all convinced themselves this was fine. And Ayn Rand's husband, Frank O'Connor, was depressed and kind of hated her and was drinking a lot and doing some useless painting and all that kind of stuff. And it was just messy and ugly and gross and weird and wrong, just wrong. And Nathaniel Brandon apparently, you know, got kind of sick and tired because he was like a decade or two younger than Ayn Rand. That she was like, she was a smoker and she was in her 60s. So, you know, it's not the most appealing slice of female flesh. But of course, Ayn Rand had this whole theory that you must love whoever is the most rational. And she would say, I, Ayn Rand, Alex Rosenbaum, I, Ayn Rand, am the most rational. You must love the most rational. I am the most rational, therefore you must love me the most. And that's a kind of a self-serving philosophy, to put it mildly. And so she could not accept that he got tired of having sex with the smoky, ashen-lunged Russian goddess of nicotine, and, come here, Nanny, Nathaniel Brandon, Mama needs some servicing. And, you know, he tried to break up with her, and she screamed and threw things, and, you know, she was on uppers for decades, right? For weight control, she was on a sort of low-grade form of speed, and of course, the nicotine, and so on. And was also depressed, I think, after the reception of Atlas Shrugged. She didn't write any more fiction from the 50s to, I think she died in 80 or 82 or something like that. And reading about what went on in objectivist circles, I remember saying to a friend of mine at the time, like after I read all of this stuff, and I saw a speech given by Barbara Brandon, and I remember the word desolate. I remember saying, I feel desolate, that this was the sort of princely army of virtuous reason, and it's kind of vile. It's kind of gross, kind of vile. It did not spark joy in me. And a lot of times people go through this with moralists. Like Noam Chomsky is one of the left's premier moralists. Sorry to bellow. I'm not that sorry. Premier. Boy, you know, it's funny. I was listening to an early show from 20 years ago. Hey, my voice sounded a little bit more spry, but that's all right. I'm getting older. And soon I'll have a Ayn Rand full-on nicotine voice. Vegas voice, I used to call it. Every time I'd go to Vegas for business or something like that, you'd always end up with in the cab with some guy. And I'm a bit of a chatterbox, so I'd ask him about his life. I came to Vegas, I don't know, about 15 years ago for the weekend, and I just never left. And this is how the good Vegas voice. Everyone's got that kind of voice, like they've been sucking on Mountain Dew, ash, and razor blades for a decade or two, and ends up with this incoherent ghoul-like growling. And I remember, feeling really desolate. So the same thing's happening with the left. Anybody with any conscience left on the left, Noam Chomsky, of course, best friends with Jeffrey Epstein long after Epstein's conviction for, whatever you want to call it, this one, long after he was a convicted sex offender, to put it as nicely as humanly possible. There were over 30 complainants, but they only charged him with one because, what was it, Jim Acosta was told, nope, Epstein belongs to intelligence. He's in deep with the alphabet agencies, so you cannot give him a big sentence. So, Noam Chomsky was best friends with Jeffrey Epstein. Long after Jeffrey Epstein's conviction, his wife was like, oh, you're a best friend. Noam just wants to give you his best wishes. And Noam Chomsky was helping, according to reports, was helping Jeffrey Epstein craft his PR response to the slight inconvenience of having been labeled a predatory sex offender and doing absolutely ghastly things to children. And Noam Chomsky was like, well, I'm an expert in power and exploitation and control and bullying and evil. And, Noam's a great guy. Super cool. He's got the best toys, throws the best parties. Excellent. And also Steve Bannon seems to be pretty corrupt in all of this as well. Yeah, and it's really sad to watch the people on X trying to rehabilitate Noam Chomsky. Like, I'm sorry, if you consider a child sexual predator. And Noam had to know. Noam had to know. If you consider a child sexual predator your best buddy, and you help him to try to rehabilitate his image, you're just a fucking evil person. But hey, at least the left still has Michel Foucault as the moral prince of darkness. God! I may have been a bit overly moralistic and fussy-based when it came to finding it kind of gross that Ayn Rand was clapping cheeks with a much younger Nathaniel Brandon and then strongly resisting any urge he had to pull away, that she was destroying her marriage and his marriage. And that's all adult stuff. That's all adults. I'm not going to go super nuts on it. It was kind of gross, but it wasn't anything like this. Ugh. All right, we got a caller. Hang on a sec. I'll get to you in a sec. I just want to get back to where you once belong. All right. Steph brags about being a professional student. Oh, listening is tough. Yeah, listening is tough. Listening is tough. I have 6 younger siblings, so I've been surrounded by and taken care of babies my whole life. I remember feeding my brother in his high chair and changing his diaper when I was 4, he was my real-life baby doll. Yeah, you've seen that, right? You've seen that where they tried to give teenage girls these fake crying dolls to lower teen pregnancy. They actually had more babies because of that. Dun, dun, dun. I had nothing but abortions. I will die alone for being a dopehead. I tried, but I was too scared and didn't make enough resources. I'm sorry to hear that. Never say never. All right. I got the power. I'll do the march of the Black Queen. All right. Once me and my wife had our son, we learned what actual meaning was. It's very true. Are there women thinking that far ahead or just doing what feels good in the moment? You're asking me to mind read. I can't mind read. I can only judge actions. Are you gay? Oh, it used to be such a happy word. Chomsky's wife was using Jeff Epstein to cut out Noam's kids. Yeah. 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 And don't buy Victoria's Secrets, to put it mildly. All right. We have a caller. Let us find out if anybody but X can hear. What's on your mind, my friend?
Good evening, Stefan. I saw you talking to Milo the other day. He has very high praise for you. So I was wondering if you had a favorite Milo moment, maybe an underrated one.
Favorite Milo. So Milo, in my particular view, I mean, obviously a brilliant writer, a brilliant communicator, a bitter and deeply bitchy, in a positive way, a moralist. And he has, of course, reformed his wilder ways, as far as I can tell. And from that standpoint, he is now a guillotine gatekeeper of thoughtery and hypocrisy on the right, which is good, which is good. I mean, he's done his work on the left and he is doing his work on the right. And as I've said in a recent show, I don't even bother consulting my own conscience anymore. I just wonder, well, if Milo was watching me, what would Milo have to say? What would Jesus do? It's like, what caustic syllables would Milo pour over my decision? Because if he finds out about it and it's a bad decision, he certainly will. So yeah, he's a bit of a flamethrower to the false fogs of hypocrisy that go on the right, which is good. I mean, you do need that particular, you know, it's the forest fire that clears out the undergrowth and renews the forest. So, yeah.
Oh, he's awesome.
Yeah, I mean, the
I'm just glad that you guys are cool with each other. I didn't know if you had any thoughts about Milo before that.
Yeah, no, Milo and I did a show or two, I think, in the past. I had criticisms of him when he seemed to be making fun of the sexual abuse that he suffered as a child, a priest. He was making jokes about how there was a particular priest who taught him how to give good oral sex. And I thought, you know, saucy humor I kind of get, but that to me was a bridge too far. And I did have some criticisms for him at the time. To his credit, and I'm not saying this has anything to do with me, but to his credit, he has rescinded those comments. And listen, that's fine. Everybody says things in the heat of the moment. Everybody says things in a faux toughness and so on that they regret. It's not like I would stand by 150% of everything I've ever said. I mean, I've said things too far and so on. So that's fine. To me, perfection is a foolish standard, but the ability to admit fault and self-correct is key. And he certainly has done that in spades. And I mean, I think he said, if I remember rightly, Milo said that his deplatforming cost him, it was either millions or tens of millions of dollars. And
almost certainly.
Yeah, because I think he would have been able to found something like the Daily Wire or maybe Glenn Beck's thing, and he would have been able to do all of that sort of stuff. And the fact that he has, you know, come back swinging, that he stayed in the ring despite all of those losses, despite all of that hostility, despite revamping his entire romantic focus and losing all of that money or not getting access to all of that money, the fact that he's still in there swinging, and as far as I know, I don't know what the status is of his health at the moment, but I do remember him having some...
Turned out it was benign. The tumor, brain tumor, was benign.
Oh, it was scanned and found to be benign?
That's what he says, yes.
Well, I suppose that's good. However, it's still a brain tumor. And, yeah. You know, I mean, benign is nice for now, right? And again, I'm not a doctor, but I mean, I had a sort of benign tumor that turned kind of nasty on me. So
pretends to hate libertarianism too. I think he's joking.
Oh, he says
he is a libertarian.
Yeah.
He is a libertarian himself. He just doesn't like how the word sounds.
I don't know anything about that, but I mean, he's taken on some immensely courageous topics over the course of his public career, and it is a very tough life to go through that kind of social attack and disapproval. And I, of course, have had the benefit and good fortune and, you know, somewhat earned stuff, but I have had the benefit of having a wonderful family. And I think Milo has had to, I don't know what the status of his relationships are, but I know that he's had, you know, real challenges that way, lots of changes. And to go through that kind of stuff alone is really, really tough. And I certainly do admire him for hanging in
there. He's a wonder worker. He really is a wonder worker. Even a couple of years ago, it was just every comment was still hating him. It's completely 180 now.
Oh, and he's on top. Sorry, what do you mean?
Well, a couple of years ago, even people were all just calling him a pedophile in the comments. People were not fucking with him, besides the rare few of us who did like him. But now he is a front runner again. He's extremely famous and liked by all.
Yeah, I mean, many years ago, he was on Bill Maher, and he recently did a Tucker, if I remember rightly. And that's good for him. So
I'll leave you with this.
Sorry, go ahead.
I'll leave you with this. Should a husband and wife work together in close quarters for their job, and they have people above them that are managing, is that ever a good idea?
Should a husband and wife work together? Why wouldn't they?
Well, there's that old saying, you don't shit where you eat, right? But I guess some people can pull it off.
Let me ask you this. Do you think the siblings should work together?
I don't think that would matter as much.
Okay.
Case by case basis.
Yeah, I mean, I talk to my wife about books and so on, and we have a lot of great conversations about stories and things like that. So I think that's fine if you get along. I would love to work with my wife. I mean, if we were in sort of the same field, she's a really great person too. And one of the things I've been enormously happy about in what I do is the ability to spend more time with my wife and my daughter than most people would as a whole. So I think it's great. I mean, to me, the more time I can spend with my wife, the better. And so, I think you have to have a good relationship. And of course, a lot of people don't really understand about how essential your partner's support is to what you do. You cannot be more successful than your spouse encourages you to be. Because a lot of people, they hit a particular rise and then they hit a particular ceiling where they start to get anxious or they start to get nervous or they start to get, oh, it's Icarus, too high, too close to the sun thing. Pride cometh before a fall. Success leads to crash and all that sort of stuff. And usually that's one partner who's ambitious, and maybe the husband's really ambitious, and maybe the wife has some social anxiety or some concern about money, or was raised to fear success or influence or money. And of course, success is dangerous. Success is difficult, because when you succeed, people are gunning for you, particularly if you're doing something, you know, moral and virtuous and more than just creating a better widget. But even if all you're doing is creating a better widget, the person ahead always has a target on their back. And so some people don't know how to negotiate or navigate that kind of stuff. And when you look at people who become sort of very famous and successful, they have a spouse who is 150% believes in them and is supportive of them. Because excellence in any field is a crazy high wire act. And you need people in your corner who believe in you, completely believe in you. Yes, you can do it. Yes, it's essential. Maybe you're the only person who can do it. And it's the most essential thing, whatever it is, right? And so if you have those people in your life who really believe in you, then you are only limited by imagination and raw ability. And if you have people in your life who don't believe in you or don't believe in you to go all the way, then you'll hit the ceiling. You'll hit the ceiling, and then it will be unconscious. It may be sabotage-based. It may just be kind of withdrawing and so on. But when I was going full tilt boogie into the podcasting world, I mean, I still had some people from my former life, you know, 20 plus years ago. And people who didn't believe that I could go all the way, I just had to cut them out. I just had to cut him out, because it's such a high wire act that any doubt that you have will cause your failure. You cannot hesitate and you cannot doubt. Now, it doesn't mean you don't self-correct and all, but that's fine. And so you absolutely need people in your life who fully believe that you can go as far as you want and that there's no ceiling on your talents. And that doesn't mean that you'll never bump into any ceiling in your talents. Maybe you will. I mean, there's lots of people who've, you know, quote, managed their career in the short term. I mean, almost everyone has managed their career a lot better than I have in terms of maintaining a public presence and so on. That wasn't my particular focus, but certainly in the short run, there's lots of people who could have given me a lot of good advice on how to deal with things. But my goal and purpose is to be right and validated and vindicated in the long run, like in 50 to 500 years. That my business plan is like 500 years, because it certainly took a long time for other persecuted thinkers and philosophers to have their reputations turned around, really a couple of hundred years for Jesus and Socrates and others, even though, well, of course, Socrates had Plato working to reform his own reputation or his reputation, but then Plato hit his own reputational hiccups and ended up being sold into slavery after running for office in Syracuse and only happened to get free because he was bought by one of his own former students for 400 drachma. So, but yeah, you have to have people who have no doubt that you can go all the way. I think sort of Brian May had his guitar called the Red Special that his engineer father helped build for him because his father had that much belief in Brian May's potential to be a world famous musician, which of course he was. And it's just really important not to underestimate just what an absolute genius Brian May is. Just for a moment. I mean, a great guitarist. He plays piano as well, composes wonderful music, writes great lyrics, sings, is a stage performer with quite a bit of charisma. And, oh, and by the by, a PhD in physics, a doctorate in physics as well. So obviously an incredible person. Always somewhat mournful, though, somewhat sad. But maybe that's just the price of having that many talents and abilities. And obviously was able to get to the very top, although I think he was suicidal at one point about his life. He was driving towards a bridge and just wanted to plunge off because, you know, it's a lot of stress and strain. Everybody sees the sort of fun fireworks and Live Aid or whatever, but it's a lot of stress and strain getting to the top. And yeah, you get a lot of targets on your back. You get a lot of attacks, as Queen did, of course. So the fact that Milo has sustained himself, and again, I don't know what his romantic situation is, but I haven't heard tell much of that sort of real pair-bonded devotional foundational bedrock that is the launch pad for a sustainable career. That is, I haven't seen that, which makes it all the more amazing that that he's able to do what he did, or is able to do what he's doing now. Kay says, I met Milo a few times and parted with him at Jeff's house. That is not Epstein, I'm pretty sure. I assume that's Berwick. I could be wrong. Please correct. I met Milo a few times, says Kay, and partied with him at Jeff's house. He's an excellent speaker and entertainer. Oh, absolutely, yeah. Oh, Anarchopulco. Yes, that's right. He emceed a whole night, and it was a riot. Oh, he's hilarious. Ha, ha, ha. Not Epstein. OMG. I'm just kidding. All right. So somebody says, I saw Milo and Tucker and found him refreshingly revealing. I would love to see you in Tucker. On Tucker, I appreciate your scrutiny and ease of speaking. Yeah, I am a good repellent. I have a natural ability to repel large shows. It's really quite remarkable. I have a wonderful ability professionally to make friends and turn them into enemies. It's really something. I have occasionally pondered over the years what the heck might be going on. But I have this make friends and break friends. People love me, and then they don't love me. People think I'm the greatest thing since sliced bread, and then they will not let their lips be sullied with the passage of my name across their mandibles. There we go. All right, so let me get back to your questions or comments or issues or troubles that I could help with. Somebody says, love Milo a lot. I love Milo a long time. But his attack on Nick Fuentes has been disgusting. I mean, Nick, it's a bit spin the wheel about his opinions, but that is, I don't really watch enough of him to know. I do find Milo very fidgety in his demeanor and his communications, because he races, his mind obviously races in so many different directions, and he gets a little hunched over, and he's very, you know, these facial expressions chase themselves across his visage like a bunch of frenetic cocaine-based wrestling ghosts and so on. All right. Ah, the British Parliament has voted massively against an investigation into the child rape scandals. Yeah. Well, I mean, let me ask you this. Steph, would you still go on Alex Jones if they invited you? I'm not really doing politics. I'm sort of out of that world, so I don't know that there's much to say. But let me ask you this. What do you think of Erica Kirk and the allegations Candace Owens has made? Oh, that the Candace Owens has said that Erica Kirk might be involved in her husband's murder? I don't believe that's true. And if it were to be true, that would... I mean, and look, I don't believe that it's true. I mean, I haven't seen any compelling evidence, so I haven't watched the show. But if it were to turn out to be true, then, and again, I don't think it would, but if it were to turn out to be true, then that would, I think, erase Charlie Kirk's legacy. I mean, not that he did, but if it turned out in some wild alternative universe that he married a murderer or something, it would just be like, oh, bro, what are you doing? I mean, aren't you supposed to pray on this stuff? And if God didn't bother to warn him, somebody says, there is pretty compelling evidence, I'm afraid. Yeah. Well, I extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence, and what can I tell you? That is a heck of an accusation to make. And I have not reviewed the evidence, so I would be beyond surprised. I mean, I will say that the glitter pants, sparkle juice, fireworks, flashpot scene of grieving doesn't seem to me particularly compelling. Like, you know, you see these pictures of Erica Kirk marching up with, you know, glitter pants and fireworks, and like, what stage of grieving is this? And I don't know. I mean, I even hate to say it, but you know, if somebody gunned down my wife on video, I would be like, I don't even know. Like, honestly, I can't even imagine. I can't even imagine. But I would not be out there doing that stuff. Yeah. Do you? I mean, I don't think anything in particular is going to happen with the Epstein stuff. I mean, remember the Panama Papers and, you know, the stuff that came out about the shooting of JFK and what came out about Nixon and what was really going on with Nixon. And, you know, I mean, I think this stuff just, it's almost like a humiliation ritual now. Like, you can let this information out because nobody's going to do anything about it. And it's just an exercise of power. Hey, look at all the stuff we can get away with, man. Isn't it beautiful? It's just part of the demoralization stuff as a whole. Somebody says, only started recently caring seriously about politics, demographics, etc., but I can't argue my opinions. Well, I can't convince my leftist friends at all. What do I need to learn? Is it even worth it? I mean, I don't know why you'd have leftist friends, to be honest, or, you know, leftist friends want to use violence against you, right? I mean, statists, they want to use violence against you. If you don't do what they want, they support you being arrested and thrown in jail. And that's... You can do a search on FDRpodcast.com for the against me argument. I did a speech at Libertopia in California, 2011, I think it was. So that's a decade and a half ago, and I still look exactly the same. As long as I have skin softener on. But yeah, look, the against me argument, don't be around people who support the use of violence against you, because they don't care about you, and they just view you as a kind of livestock to serve their ideology. So, are we only as virtuous as circumstances allow? No, we are as virtuous as we choose to be. And excessive virtue can cause death. There's no more dangerous extreme sport than excessive virtue. Because you can certainly say stuff in the public square that will get you killed. I mean, we can see all that pretty clearly, right? That there's absolutely things. And if you spend any time, of course, in the public square, then you kind of understand that. But there are things that you can say in the public square, if you have any kind of reach, that will just get you killed. Yep. So as far as debating goes, artoftheargument.com, artoftheargument.com, I've got a really great book on how to debate. All right. Let me just get to your questions and comments. Let me see. What's the meta way to approach progressives in the San Francisco Bay Area about the horrible conditions without being labeled a doom looper? I mean, one of the reasons that I stopped doing politics is, I mean, the time for debate and arguments is long past. I mean, maybe you can do a way better job than I did, but I've been arguing this stuff since I was 15 years old, which is almost 45 years. You know, round it up. A little bit with it's a half a century of me debating and arguing these ideas, and I think I've been pretty effective. Like I've had millions of books downloaded, I've done a billion views and downloads, I have been pretty effective. And you know, one day I'll talk about all the behind the scenes stuff, but I have been pretty effective at doing all this kind of stuff. And I mean, you've seen how it's played out for me. I'm one of the more effective communicators of philosophy, reason, and evidence to the general population. I don't use technical terms. I sprinkle a fair amount of humor and stories and analogies into what it is that I do. So I do have, I think, a fair amount of skill in the communication. I think it's hard to find a philosopher who is more innovative, more creative, a better speaker, more rational, a better debater. I'm pretty good at all of this kind of stuff. Maybe you're way better, which is great. Then that would be wonderful. But the problem, somebody said, has Steph always had high self-esteem? I don't. I don't have a high self-esteem. I am very skeptical of everything I put forward, which is where I try to make things as rational and consistent as possible. I am empirical in that if I have repeatedly proven that I have particularly good abilities, I will accept that. But as far as high self-esteem, I always assume that I'm wrong and fight like heck with myself and with reason and with evidence to be right. I always assume that I'm wrong, and then I work to be right. So, would you like to know, I realized something today. I don't know if this is interesting to you. I can't tell because I cannot read the mind of the Borg brain of the free domain. But I wanted to know, would you like to know why I am no Christian? Why I am no Christian? Do you want to know why? For me, it is no the cross. I am cross with the cross. Do you want to know why I am not a Christian? That's what I want to know. That just dissolved into Mario babble. Do you want to know? Why? Hit me with a why if you want to know. why? I just realized this today. Like, why I'm not a Christian. Just realized. Tell us about yourself. There is no linguistic cliche that I will not absolutely embrace. And get the both hands upside down. To put on the VR headset. You put on the VR headset and then you put on the controllers and you say, give me Italian hands. All right. We've got some yes. Somebody says, thank you. Your opinion means a lot to me. One is my sister and I can't really avoid them. We mostly get along. But they treat immigration and the issues as right-wing agitprop and happy types. Yeah. Well, you can just ask them, would they like to take immigrants into their own home? Right? Or, if you disagree with immigration, would they accept you not having to fund it? Right? Do-do-do. He's not a Christian. They're telling me why. I do, but I also want to see more of this acting. LOL. LOL. I do the cheesiest accents. I was on a date once where the woman challenged me to do every accent under the sun. Why talk like an Italian? It would make more sense for you to talk like an Irish or the German. I don't know that with my square jaw, round head, and blue eyes that I should be speaking like a German. I feel that that would be dubbed. all right, so it looks like the people want to know why and what accent do you want me to speak in? Anyway, so yeah, I realized why I have remained super godless all this time. Maybe I'll just do Duke Nukem voice. I can't. It will make my throat sore. And I'll probably end up speaking like that eventually anyway. So, no Irish or German. So, I realized this. And I won't tell you the circumstances upon which I realized this. Your jaw is like Jim Carrey in The Mask. Laser. With a smidge of wattle. You know, if I need to store nuts for the winter, I'll just put them in the little pouch there. So you can find my pulse and my past lives. So I realized, so the answer was something like this. So if you imagine you had the ability to cure people of cancer by touching their forehead, like if you could find my forehead, right, let's say. So you have the ability to cure cancer by touching people's foreheads. What would you do with your life? Well, you'd have to race around curing cancer, right? You'd have to do that. I mean, could you say, well, you know, I don't really want to go down to the cancer ward in Minneapolis because, you know, the new Fallout show just dropped, and right, you would feel this compulsion. You got to wake up and get to touching people, and then you fall asleep somewhere and you get up and you, right, because there's way more people getting cancer than you can cure because you got to go around touching people in the forehead. And it would be a real frantic life of you got to just cure people from cancer, right? Now, if I were Christian, hell would be very vivid and very real for me. And if people did not accept Jesus, I would have to really, really work tirelessly night and day for as long as I could stand and speak and not pass out from exhaustion. I would have a giant ministry. I would be speaking. I would be cajoling. I would be not threatening, but threatening on the behalf of God of the consequences of hell. I would be doing all that stuff. Because curing someone of cancer is important. But it is infinitely more important to cure people from going to hell. And everyone who believes in the afterlife believes in hell. Everyone. It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter what the outcome of the story is. It doesn't matter. Everyone who believes in it. Because what is the afterlife, right? The afterlife is you live forever with your soul or in some immaterial form. And everyone says, well, the afterlife is really cool. It's really good. It's really positive. It's really fun. It's really great. You get to spend time with loved ones. You get to reunite with blah, blah, blah. And it's like, well, but what if in the afterlife there are rapists and murderers and serial killers and just horrible, toxic people who can sift through your innards because you're all immaterial and floating through each other's ghost atoms? So, oh, no, it can't work that way. It can't work that way. It can't be that the afterlife is going to be full of evil people, because then the afterlife would be, well, just kind of like life, right? What is life? Life is a general series of finding a good group of relatively nice people, and then some asshole worms his or her way in, starts causing trouble, and then splinters the group, and everyone defers to that person, and that's it. What the hell happened there on X? X just completely vanished. Let's see here. What happened on X? Well, it's running. It's just not running for me. Sorry, 1 second. We're back to Luigi. All right, let's go here. And I was born by the river. Scroll and scroll and scroll and go and start and join. Reconnect to space. Oh my God, you've got video. Oh, it's much more worth it now. You don't have to suffer with only the vocal stylings and not the giant ostrich egg capped forehead mauling you. Oh, I should also turn my mic back on. There we go. All right, so we're back on X and the mic is on. There we go. Camera is on. We're back. We're back. So, yeah, so if I was a Christian, I would never be able to rest, because saving people, like Catcher in the Rye style, saving people from the fires of hell would be absolutely essential. Because nobody thinks that there's an afterlife full of bad people, right? I mean, have you ever had this where you, hey, it seems like a pretty nice group. And then some lunatic, some psycho, some sociopath, some whatever evildoer comes in, blows up the group, causes problems, trolls, and the whole group. I mean, people gather together, and then they just get atomized and blown to the winds by the usual suspects, the manipulators, the psychos, the sociopaths, the cold-hearted, the narcissistic. Right? You ever have that? Yeah, X is back up. So sorry about that. It crashed. It crashed. I'm in Florida, somebody says somebody, but I think you were doing City Hall podcast in the California area just before YouTube had their issue with you. Yeah. I mean, it was all a bunch of things together. I remember your peaceful parenting and your car videos and your commute to work. Your early work on philosophy helped me tremendously. Oh, thank you. I appreciate that. Grok says IQ differences come from environmental factors. Africa was warm. There was not as many pressures for intelligence. Less people who plan, less die in the cold, to sum it up. Yeah, for sure. For sure. For sure. I know some people in a strict Christian group, says someone, their conception of hell is absolutely brutal, and they do things like waking up at the break of dawn daily. Must be tough to have to do all of that to avoid hell. Yeah, I just, I take ideas, obviously, I take ideas super duper seriously. I take ideas very, very, very seriously, for better or for worse. I mean, I think for better as a whole, but I take ideas very seriously. Let me just keep repeating that until everybody dies, like Yoda. But because I take ideas very seriously, if I believed that people were heading to hell without the strong intervention of accepting Jesus, that's all I could do with my life. I would wake up and save people from hell And then I would do that until I passed out in the evening. And then I would wake up and I would save people from hell. And I don't understand Christians, because that's what they should be doing, but they don't. I've never met a Christian who does that. I'm sure there are some who do that, but I have never, met people who are Christians who do that. But isn't that the, you know, that you can touch people on the forehead and save them from cancer? You can reason and convince people and save them from hell. So why aren't they doing that? Like, this is sort of way back. Oh gosh, this is spiraling back in time. Oh, in my early 20s, I ran my own little computer consulting business. I didn't have a car, so I had to take like 4 buses sometimes, and then sometimes just walk for an hour to get to particular businesses off the bus route. And there was a guy, I worked in his business, and I was able to connect his printer to the network back in the days when you had to do this through DOS and virtual ports and all kinds of crazy stuff. But I would always go in and solve problems. I was always able to go in and fix and solve the problems. And there was one guy who was going to hire me. He wasn't quite decided. And then he tried to boot up his computer and he had a virus. And then I was able to take the virus out in about 5 minutes. And then he's like, "You're hired," right? Anyway, so this guy wanted me to do his office, and then he wanted me to do his network at home. This is back in the day when it was really difficult to set up networks. This would be, gosh, almost 40 years ago. And he was very Christian. And I said, you know, to be polite, and also I'm very impressed by people who have nice houses. I just am. And I walked in this beautiful place, and he was an accountant, ran his own accounting business. And I said, "Ah, this is a lovely place you had here." And he said, I remember this very clearly. He said, "Yes, God has been very good to us." Oof. Boy, that sent me on a real theological spiral just to go, "Oh, yes, God's been very good to us." Yeah, well, I guess God just wasn't good to me, bro. God's been very good to us. Yeah. All right. But I would like to hear your philosophical take on the world leader saber rattling. Brett Weinstein seems a bit worried. That worries me. I'm not sure what you mean by saber rattling. I mean, there's no point having weapons if nobody believes you'll use them. Right? If nobody believes that you'll ever use your weapons, there's no point having them. So the fact that they're saber rattling is kind of like the point of that. For me, the question is, what came before the universe? No, it isn't. With all due respect, I love you, you're a donor, but that's not for you. That's not for you. If the big, like as the world crumbles under endless onslaughts of evil and lies and propaganda and misdirection and antinatalism for the best and pronatalism for the worst, as the universe and the world around us crumbles into evil, the idea that the big moral issue in your life is what came before the beginning of the universe, I mean, it's bullshit. I mean, honestly, it's just a distraction. It's a cope, right? I mean, if you listen to the show, you're kind of like an expert surgeon. Like, you can save people. You can save people. And can you imagine you bring your child who's dying into an ER, and the doctor's like, "Yes, but I bet I could save your child for sure. But I'm really pondering what came before the universe." Wouldn't you be like, "Shut up and save my child"? So no, that's just something you're using to distract yourself and feel deep, rather than, you know, the difficult and dangerous work of actually opposing evil. When you say philosophy comes to you, that it's not from you, could that be God, the other? No, it's like your dreams come to you. You don't, like when you go to sleep at night, your dreams come to you. And people always say, songs came to me, this idea came to me, the guy who figured out the structure of some atom is a snake eating its own tail, that just came to him in a dream. There's a lot of creativity that just kind of comes to you, because if creativity could be willed, then people would never run out of cool creative stuff to be doing. So no, it doesn't. When I say philosophy comes from me, it means that there's a giant unconscious engine of philosophy that gives me analogies and gives me metaphors and gives me arguments and gives me rebuttals and gives me responses and so on. And they just, I mean, there's a certain amount of training, but the training happens because I'm already good at it. So philosophy kind of flows through me in the same way that dreams come to you, but God isn't giving you the dreams, just your unconscious activity, right? Like your unconscious has been clocked at 6,000 times faster than your conscious mind. Are we near the end? Just arrived. I don't know. Depends on whether I get more questions. Do you think the TPUSA counter show during the Super Bowl held high enough quality? I don't know. I watched the Bad Bunny thing and I mean, it's just shouting about sex and banging a drum. I mean, it's not even music. Oh, sex. And it was so cliched. What is Hispanic culture? Cutting sugarcane, which apparently hasn't happened in many Hispanic cultures for quite some time. Going to the grocery store, getting some juice, twerking, simulated sex. Strangely enough, gay sex in the back of a pickup truck apparently is quite Hispanic as well. What else? Well, EBT cards, right? And welfare, because, you know, half of the island of Puerto Rico is on food stamps and half is reliant upon government programming. So, all right. If not Christianity, do you believe that a higher power exists at all? What would truth actually be grounded in if not? Okay, tell me what the definition is of a higher power. I don't know what you mean by a higher power. Bring me a higher power. If the possibility of future enhancement, genetic, neurological, technological, justifies granting moral protections to currently non-moral agent humans, whether severe psychopaths, profoundly impaired individuals, or entire populations argued to lack average moral capacity, then why doesn't the exact same logic apply to animals, which could also be uplift of moral agency in the future? Jesus, man. You all fiddling while Rome burns, these kinds of questions. I mean, this is not the big moral issues in your life. What if some future technology turns apes into human beings? Why don't we blah, 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 blah? Come on. Come on, these are not the big moral issues. This is just ookie cookie, right? How do we quit smoking? You have to figure out what was so tough in your childhood that you're dopamine deficient and therefore nicotine gives you more dopamine. How would you define philosophy? Philosophy is the definition, pursuit, and exposition of moral truth, moral virtues. No, you can't quit addictions. It's just white knuckling you because you're right. You have to figure out what caused the nicotine addiction. And the nicotine addiction is because, like, but doesn't nicotine produce testosterone or something? So if you were raised by a single mother or in a very male hostile environment, you're more likely to want to smoke, I assume, because it gives you, allows you to put that sort of stuff at bay, if that makes sense. Is that, I think it does. Let me just check here. Does nicotine produce, sorry, I have to type through 14 different cables here. Do a nicotine produce the testosterone? Smokers had higher mean testosterone levels than non-smokers. Smokers showed roughly 15% total testosterone, 15% higher total testosterone and 30% higher free testosterone in some large population studies. Cotinine from nicotine may competitively inhibit enzymes that break down androgens, leading to slower clearance and higher circulating testosterone. Some suggest nicotine or cotinine might inhibit aromatase, reducing conversion of testosterone. So it's not for certain, for sure, but it does seem to be that it does seem to be perhaps a replacement for lower testosterone that might come out of single motherhood or other things that lower testosterone. So look at that. And, you know, find other ways that maybe you could raise your T levels so that you maybe wouldn't need as much. Because if you have low testosterone, you have higher anxiety, right? So because you're more feminine, so you worry more. And so there's lots of ways to raise your testosterone. I'm not a doctor, so don't take any advice from me, but just, you know, go talk to your doctor or look it up yourself and get your testosterone level checked. Ba-dum, ba-dum. All right. Being raised by a difficult single mother is also a good predictor of a Stephen Molyneux addiction. Yeah, and I sympathize. I really do. I really do. I used to suck my thumb beyond when I should have, and then I only stopped when I spent a night in my father's house, and it never came back. The desire never came back. I guess I would describe a higher power as the thing or system of things that enables or allows reality to exist with all its multiplicity. The thing or system of things that enables or allows reality to exist. Why would reality need to be enabled to exist? Existence exists. Atoms and energy are atoms and energy. They are eternal. They are perpetual. They can only be converted from one form to another. So I'm not sure why a higher power would be needed. Like, if I have a coffee cup, is God concentrating on my coffee cup to keep it existing? I'm an addict. What can I say? There's a drag. So, yeah, I mean, does God need to concentrate on everything or a higher power in order to maintain its existence? I don't know why you would need that. I mean, we know scientifically that things exist, right? Many super feminine gals are low in anxiety. That's why boys like them so much. And you're just saying stuff. many, my experience, many, right? So a lot of times, very feminine women will pair up with very masculine men. I mean, I think that's got something to do with my marital success. So very feminine women will team up with very masculine men. And then the men generally are strong and protective and so on, which allows the women to relax. So I have heard of Dr. Shiva, but I don't really know much about him. All right, so let's see here. Any other questions? All right. As Stanism is the opposite of Christianity, I don't know what Stanism is, is that a typo for Satanism? Honestly, if you can't be bothered to check your text for typos, why would I want to bother reading it? Reality is objective and consistent, but are atoms really eternal and perpetual? Well, yeah, you can't destroy atoms. You can convert them to energy and back. But yeah, so honestly, I mean, if you can't be bothered to, like, if I'm supposed to guess your meaning in typos, then I'm not going to bother. Like, honestly, it's kind of rude, especially in a live stream where I'm reading stuff. If you can't even just spend like literally 10 seconds to proofread, then I'm not going to bother reading it. I suppose it's like the observer effect. Why do atoms behave differently depending on if somebody observes them or not? Yeah, I don't know that that's actually true. I mean, I don't know that that's actually true. Okay, what are criticisms of the atomic observer effect? Not affect, effect. It doesn't matter what the outcome of the story is. All right, misinterpretation as requiring consciousness or a mind. The most widespread criticism is the popular claim, often in New Age pseudoscience or quantum mysticism context, that human consciousness or looking with a mind causes wave function collapse or changes reality. Mainstream physics rejects this. Observation means physical interactions or measurement. A detector absorbing a photon, entangling with the system, or scattering particles, not subjective awareness. Critics point out that detectors, cameras, or even environmental particles can observe and cause the same effect without any human conscious involvement. Right. So this view has been labeled a misconception rooted in early Copenhagen interpretation language and poor popularizations. John Bell famously mocked it. Mock, mock, a game of tennis. Mock, mock, mock. John Bell famously mocked it. Was the wave function waiting to jump for thousands of millions of years until a single-celled living creature appeared, or did it have to wait a little longer for some highly qualified measurer with a PhD? Even Eugene Wigner, who once entertained consciousness collapse ideas, later abandoned them. Many conflate the observer effect with Heisenberg's uncertainty principle, claiming measurement disturbs position or momentum due to the observer's intrusion. While early explanations, including by Heisenberg, sometimes used disturbance language, modern understanding shows the uncertainty principle is fundamental to quantum mechanics itself. It's about inherent incompatibility of observables, not just measurement back action. So, yeah, it's not. Some claim the observer effect proves reality is mind-dependent or that observation creates reality. Critics counter that quantum systems behave consistently, whether observed or not. The effect is how we gain information, not about reality needing observers in order to exist. The universe evolved for billions of years with quantum processes, e.g. stellar fusion, early particle interactions, long before conscious observers appeared, showing no need for minds to collapse anything for physical processes to occur. Anyway, this kind of goes on and on. In short, the atomic scale observer effect is legitimate physics. Measurement disturbs quantum systems. It would be like if you had a game of a pool with a blind man, and the blind man had to feel the balls in order to know where they were. Well, if he touched the balls, he would move them, right? So, but claims tying it to consciousness, mind over matter, or reality being created by observation are heavily criticized as misunderstandings or exaggerations. Mainstream quantum mechanics explains the effect through physical interaction and decoherence without needing conscious observers. So, yeah, it's not a real thing. It's not a real thing, man. Do not do it. All right. I appreciate staying focused, but you recently talked about moral treatment in detail. I've been thinking about this and how this relates to our dealings with people who seem almost wholly incapable of being moral. I don't know what that means, sorry. All right. Well, listen, I appreciate everyone dropping by tonight. If you're listening to this later, freedomain.com/donate to help out the show. Would hugely, massively, deeply, and humbly appreciate your support. freedomain.com/donate. And have yourself a beautiful, wonderful, lovely evening, my friends. And I really, really appreciate you dropping by tonight. We will talk to you Friday night for Friday Night Live. And good night. Good night, my friends. Thanks, Emil, as always. Bye.